This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And it is Booktown. I'm Eric Tome. I'm going to be with you till the end of the hour, relating mostly with books about travel in one way or another. All authors who are going to be appearing in Nevada County this week. We're going to have a pre-recorded interview with Amy Tan, a telephone interview with Jason Roberts, who is the author of A Sense of the World, How a Blind Man Became the World's Greatest Traveler. And finally, I'll talk in the studio with Mark Lyon, who's presenting Ghosties and Ghoulies and Long-Legged Beasties and Things That Go Bump in the Night this Thursday at the Miner's Foundry in Nevada City. This is also an extension of KPMR's membership drive. And that may seem unfortunate to some people who just want to listen to regular old broadcasting, but it's really not, because this is just another opportunity to get some wonderful gifts if you choose to join KBMR and become a member. And in particular, we have tickets for Amy Tan, who will be appearing at the Wordslingers Festival this Saturday, October 21st at 7:30 p.m. at the Grass Valley Veterans Hall. They have tickets, $25 tickets. A pair of those is a $50 value. Those are for the downstairs seating. We have one set of those, which will be available with an $89.50 donation to KVMR. We also have three pairs of the balcony tickets. Those are $15 a piece, so it's a $30 value, and you can get those for a $60 pledge. So that should be a good incentive to get going. We also have, for higher amounts, Amy and David Goodman's new book, Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back. That's available at $89.50. And also Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance, the American Empire Project by Noam Chomsky, also for $89.50. Or for $60, Molly Fisk's Radio Essays for Radio, Using Your Turn Signal Promotes World Peace. I'd like to thank a couple of people who contributed in the last hour. Jason Toby, who came in at $120 rate and took the Earth Mysteries gift pack. And also Gwen Moore came in as a $60 member. Many thanks to both of you for joining, and I hope I'll be thanking more people in this hour. As I mentioned, the Amy Tan tickets are immediate value, and we didn't think we were going to offer these until the membership drive was extended. But it's going now, and that's a great opportunity to get either floor seats, those are $25 value, two of those, or we have three pair of the $15 bleacher seats, which would be available with a $60 pledge to KVMR. But I'm going to stop talking now and get straight into the discussion with Amy Tan. It takes about 23 minutes. I may stop in the middle to remind you what you can get. In any case, it's mostly talking about her latest novel, Saving Fish from Drowning. You're sort of famous as being the chronicler of the difficult lives of Chinese-American mothers and daughters. You've done this through four novels that have been very successful, from The Joy Luck Club to the Bonesetter's Daughter. And now all of a sudden you're taking a huge jump. It's almost as if you've jumped ship with the Saving Fish from Drowning. You've got a little bit of that in there, but you're really doing a much larger, much more comical take on Americans of different sorts traveling in Asia. Were you just tired of Mothers and Daughters?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, there's actually, in spite of what seems to be a huge difference in what I've written in the past, a continuation in, to my mind. The narrator of the story is actually the voice of my mother, meaning it's based on her voice, her sense of things, the way she would tell a story. So to me, it's still very much about the kind of things I've always written about, but it's a different way of expressing it. This particular woman is dead, the narrator. And in part, that was fueled by what had happened at the time that I was starting the story, which is that my mother had died. And I was very sad that she wouldn't be there to inspire or sort of serve as my muse for my stories. But it was as if she said, well, I can still be in the story. I don't have to be a mother. I can tell the story. And I realized that was true. And so she is the voice of the narrator. When I say that she's the voice and she's part of the continuation of everything that I've written, it's not simply the way she tells these things. My mother had a particular way of looking at the world, and as much as anything, I was writing about that in my earlier books, the differences between how she and I believed in different things, but also saw through these differences with a mutual heart. My mother believed in fate. She believed in bad luck. She believed in not listening to your mother as being the source of many bad things that happened to you, and she believed she could undo fate. She believed in all the possibilities, and this is a narrator who also does. She just takes us into the larger world to look at that.
Although she seems like a much more extravagant person than the mothers in your earlier novels.
She's cranky. She's biased. She's opinionated. She's feisty. She's a little arrogant at times. And my mother was all of those things. My mother was more than all the characters I've ever written about, including Bibi Chen in this latest book. But my mother was the same kind of things that are in this character. And the parts of her that I did love. She was a kind of a snob from Shanghai, and she was very critical. She'd point out people's flaws and kind of read into what people were really thinking and why they did something. And so, yeah, she's definitely there.
I had two other thoughts as I was reading the book. One, I had read your essay about your love affair with Nabokov.
Uh-huh.
And it struck me that perhaps because the narrator in this case was dead and much more free-floating, you could take up let yourself go a bit in his direction with a little more wordplay, although there's wordplay in all of your novels, but a little more extravagant and a little more arrogance and a little more just of that more worldly attitude.
Well, thank you for the the even partially close comparison of ever approaching anything that Nabokov did. With language. Yes, I'm a huge admirer of what he wrote and the intelligence behind every single word and even punctuation that he had in his books. I did have a good time, you know, playing with the language, but and I also think that what I was writing about was not really poking fun at American tourists, because they do think that what I had written could apply to anybody in any country, going into the country that they're not really certain about. They're not really clear on whatever the situation is overall politically or even culturally. And so there's bound to be a kind of misperception and comedy of errors that you often see. In a story, of course, we magnify them and keep them playing off of one another.
But these people are so well-intentioned, but they each have their blind spots, and in spite of their well-intentions, they each make horrible faux pas.
They each have their secret desires, too, and I think they often fuel what our intentions are. They make some cultural gaffes, but I think what predominates is their sense of heart in approaching a very difficult situation with other people who are suffering and not knowing quite what to do and being caught into it themselves and having the need to save their own skins. I have felt that in various ways myself, and I think that we all run into situations where people are suffering and we're thinking, well, what should we do? When you pass a homeless person, you know, that idea, well, I can't save the world, or I feel terrible about this person, I'm going to go work at a soup kitchen, or I'm going to give money to an organization that helps to create jobs, or I'll give a dollar to this person today, or I'll say hi and treat them like a real human being. Or it runs the gamut of how we respond to the suffering of other people. And then not knowing what of our actions or inaction will leave as a consequence. If the consequence is actually not a good one, what is it that we follow up on at all? Do we have a moral response and a feeling, well, even though my intentions were good and this terrible outcome happened, should I feel responsible? It's such a quagmire for me to think about that I just knew I had to write about it, because whenever something really troubles me, then I think, well, there's a good point for a novel. You know, I need to figure it out in a longhand form.
Was it your own travels to Myanmar that had led to this, or?
I was invited, and at first I thought, like the characters in the book, that things had improved there. You know, I also had to stop and say, Myanmar, where is that? Oh, Burma. Yeah, I remember Burma. And then I started reading about it, and I thought, oh, well, things are worse than ever. And the woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize, Aung San Suu Kyi, she's still under house arrest. And then I had, you know, read that people are not supposed to go there to show their protest of the military regime that took over. But then I thought to myself, well, should I feel good about this? Should I pat myself in the back and say I really help people when I'm just going to go on vacation somewhere else? And, you know, and I just get myself into these moral labyrinths that go round and round and round. And I figured that I should really think about this and ask more questions. Apart from that, though, this is a question that's come up to me over and over again, because starting with the time that I was published, people would say to me, say things to me like, well, you should go over to China and stand in Tiananmen Square and protest what the government is doing there. And at first I thought, well, yeah, I should do that. But later I realized that, would that really serve any purpose? Would that really make things better for people over there? And I also knew that if I did that, I would make things very difficult for my family who lives there. Would I then suffer those consequences? No. Would I feel responsible to my family if they were punished? I should. So I really had to think about why I would do something like that in the name of helping people and be aware of what could possibly happen and whether or not I truly would be helping people or not. So with all of this, I'm just saying that there is really no right answer. I mean, it's such an individual thing, but I had to ask myself all the questions and play through from the very difficult and heartfelt to the kind of ridiculous, which includes some of the reasons that I think about things.
Yeah. So. In your earlier novels, the moral problems are quite knotty, and the questions of loyalty and independence and all the things that go on within families and between cultures. Here the touch is much lighter, and probably because Bibi Chen is seen through her eyes.
Yeah.
And it's much more comic And I, at a certain point, I also had the impression, you know, this is almost like a Dave Barry novel.
Yeah.
And I know that he's one of the people you sometimes hang out and make music with.
Uh-huh.
Any sense to that?
Well, I had not thought about that, but maybe there is some aspect that's rubbed off on me about Dave Barry. I actually think now that the kind of I don't know, the kind of humor or the kind of interest in looking at what's ludicrous has always been there for me. And I actually thought that my earlier books were more funny than perhaps people thought they might be. They were, you know, I always got this comment that the books were poignant mother-daughter tales, you know, and for the men, tearjerkers or something. But to me, there was as much that was funny in the books as I was writing it for myself, as there were things that were painful and difficult and, in a way, transformative for me as I was unlocking doors to the past and confronting those issues again.
I was thinking that maybe it was easier for there to be a light touch here because B.B. Chen is childless. And she sort of looks upon the people who take the trip as, well, she calls them my friends all the time, but she's looking at them in a very maternal way, but very distant.
Yeah. She's without a mother and without a child. She really doesn't belong to anyone in one sense. My mother was somebody who always regretted that she had lost her mother when she was very young and felt she wasn't feeling as deeply as most people would be able to if they had a mother, and that some of the mistakes in her life or the inadequacies had to do with the loss of the mother. And so B.B. Chen has that as well. And she has no children, and yet she begins to feel what I think many of us feel when we do have kids or when we are caught in a situation where we have to somehow be the ones responsible for the care of others. I think there's a sense of what her responsibilities are and her desires also to make people see things in a certain way, which is, of course, what my mother also did with me.
This is Booktown on KBMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, playing a pre-recorded interview with Amy Tan. She's going to be coming to Grass Valley this Saturday. She's going to be at the Veterans Hall at 7:30 as part of this year's Word Slingers Festival. And in the just extended KBMR membership drive, this has given us the opportunity to offer you some tickets, four pairs of tickets to Amy Tan this Saturday. For a $60 contribution, you can get two tickets for the bleachers, that's $15 each, $30 in all, or for $89.50, a pair of floor tickets. Those are valued at $25 each or $50 in all. You can call 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. That's 1-800-355-KBMR. There's other things you can get as well. Amy and David Goodman's new book, Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back. Also Noam Chomsky's Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. And Molly Fisk's Essays for Radios, Using Your Turn Signal Promotes World Peace. And Steve Baker has an opinion on this, too.
Well, the opinion is that if shows like Booktown and interviews with some of the most extraordinary authors in this country, one of them whom Eric is talking to right now, Amy Tan, is of importance to you, if it's something that you enjoy, please show your support by going to your phone right now and call 265-9555 in the 530 area code or 800-355-5867. And with the Amy Tan tickets, we should also remind people, if you're out of the area, if you pay with a credit card, we can put them in the mail perhaps as early as today, certainly tomorrow, and you would get them in plenty of time.
Or we can save them at the door.
Oh, that's true, too.
I think that might be the preferred method.
Okay. So, you know, just, yeah, the talk to the folks out here, and we can figure it out. So, but there's only four pairs of it, and we would certainly, and this Word Slingers were so kind to give us these, to donate these tickets to KVMR. They know the importance of a show like Booktown and a station like KVMR that gives the local local and national and international literary scene a presence in Nevada County. 530-265-9555, 800-355-5867, and well beyond Nevada County for that matter. Close to 40% of people listening to our voices right now are in the immediate Sacramento area, which is one of the big places where a lot of folks listen. And that Noam Chomsky book is the one that Hugo Chavez recommended that the current administration and Americans at large read. So it's got Hugo Chavez's endorsement, and he held it up at his speech at the United Nations. So and then apparently it jumped from all the way up to the top 10 books or something like that, just because of the endorsement from him.
He may be more powerful than KVMR, but we're doing our best. We want to return to the Amy Goodman interview. We're going to go right back to it, but please call us at 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867, which is 1-800-355-KVMR.
And again, any gift of $60 or more, which this would be today, also gets you. Although you should remember to ask for it if you could. You can get the fabled KVMR chocolate CD made of Belgian chocolate. You don't put this in your CD player.
You put it in your mouth.
You put it in your mouth, and it's us trying to be if you are sweet to us today, we can be sweet to you. That's what we figure.
Okay, 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. Let's hear some more of Amy Tan.
It's kind of funny to me that in your earlier books, which other people see as rather tense moral dramas, you see a lot of humor. And in this book where I see a lot of humor, you're seeing pretty stark moral choices.
I see a number of things that in my books that are not one or the other. They're always a combination of both. And I often think that the most painful things, the most serious things, sometimes require humor to make them become, almost palatable to even think about, to look at it without some kind of moral seriousness that somehow dictates what the conclusion is before you've even started to look at what the issues are.
Boy, I'm getting... So you had decided, I think when I look at this book, I think that the characters are all people with conflicts, but there's no clear resolution.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You hadn't really ended with a, you didn't start with a resolution in mind.
No, I didn't want one. In fact, with all of my books or anything that I believe or in any situation, I think what people might consider fence-sitting is for me this absolute imperative in my life not to come to any definitive conclusions on what I see as an absolute truth on what you should do or how things are. To me, the stories are never finished, and if you were to turn to another page, it would continue and another complication would happen. And that's pretty much how I feel about a lot of things in life. There is no one way that we should think about these things or that it can be right or wrong. If anything, I suppose I always knew that I wouldn't have some sort of resolution for anybody or some easy answer. With each of those characters at the very end, there's something open-ended about all of them.
I think it's kind of funny that I could see, from having read some of your autobiographical essays, I could see in earlier books how certain characters were based on experiences from your family life. Mm-hmm. And in this case, where the death of the mother is similar, you had already related, I could see that, but I thought you were really trying to get away from your family and just throwing in a few incidents. But you say that in some ways this is the closest to your mother.
It is, by taking her point of view, it's an enormously wide point of view, and applying it to the outside world. I could take that voice and go anywhere in the world and apply it to a moral situation, and I would find a lot of humor and a lot of contradictions, and it would open my observations up in so many different ways. Because my mother did not believe in one consistent philosophy. She believed in all of it. She could believe in miracles. She could believe in DNA and medical breakthroughs. She could believe in fate and bad luck and curses and all of that, which is a wonderful canvas then for a fiction writer. Because in telling a story, you have to say what happened and why, to some degree. And when you have a character who believes that what happened and why is all over the place, you know, it to me makes for a very unpredictable story with all kinds of surprises for me, the writer, as I'm writing it.
Remembering the mothers in some of the earlier books, and it sounds like we're going to talk about mothers an awful lot, like especially Joy Luck Club or Bonesetter's Daughter, I was quite surprised when I read your essay about what happened after your brother and father died, that your mother had basically picked you up and taken you to Europe, to Holland and then to Switzerland.
Yeah.
And I could not have imagined the mothers from those two books having done that. But I could easily imagine B.B. Chen doing it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, people think, well, you know, this mother is nothing like your mother as they were in the other books. But I want to say, no, that feistiness of B.B. was definitely my mother. I'm older than my mother was at the time that my father and brother died. But I ask myself sometimes, if I had been in her shoes, if I had a husband and a son who just died and I had these two surly, unhappy, angry teenagers, would I just chuck it all in and take them off to a foreign country where I couldn't speak the language and had no idea where I would live or where they'd go to school? I look back and I think my mother was both very, very brave and she was also insane.
Well, enough about your mother. It's been almost 20 minutes talking. Have you sort of exercised? Well, here I'm coming right back to her. Have you exercised her? Is she going to appear in your future work?
Oh no, she's always around. You know, I mean, who I am as a writer is so much informed by my mother and who she was and the kind of questions she forced me to think about. I think some part of her will always be in my books.
What are you working on now, though? Have you moved to a new topic, or are you just sort of taking time off?
Well, I'm working on a number of different things. I mean, just in terms of projects, I'm working on an opera. I'm writing libretto for an opera based on The Bonesetter's Daughter. I'm also working on an article for National Geographic. I'm based on a village I just visited in China.
What village?
It's a village in southwestern Guizhou, which is nothing, a village no one's ever heard of. It's a tiny little village of about 1,300 people. And about a fifth of the homes there burned down recently. So I went there and stayed there for 12 days. I just got back, as a matter of fact, just the other day.
Was it the Geographic that said you should go there, or did you want to? Or?
They asked me to write a story, and I thought, I don't have time to do that. But then all of a sudden I remembered this village I'd gone to for 2 days, and I'd always wanted to go back. And I said, hey, how about if I write about this village? And they said, great. It's for a special China issue they're doing. It's all about China. So every story is about China. And so this is their one about, this issue is about transformation. And this is about a village that will, like all of China, go through transformation. I'm also going to be working on a TV series and then a new novel. And the novel will, again, have some qualities of my mother's voice. And I wouldn't be surprised if it took place in that little village in Guizhou.
I think it was in the Joy Luck Club that the mother figure there said, when you go to China, you'll find out that you really are Chinese. Did that happen?
Well, my mother said it both ways. She said, as soon as your feet touch China, you'll be Chinese. And she also said, when you get, you know, when I was worried, I'd get there and everybody would say, oh, you belong here, and they wouldn't let me to come back. This is, you know, 20 years ago. My mother just said, oh, the minute you open the your mouth, they know you're not Chinese. You don't belong there. The minute you walk, they know, you know, you're not Chinese at all. So she said it both ways. And I do feel exactly that. My mother was right. There are times that I'm in China and I feel this is a country I really belong to. My family history and what shaped me belongs here. And the other is I'm there and I stick out so much as somebody who clearly does not belong. I had to take a translator with me to the little village in order to speak to people who have a very thick accent of their tribe. But after a week, I found that I could understand pretty much everything they were saying. So, you know, it just depends on the context, and after a while I become more this and less that, and it's never one thing more than the other forever. It's always in transition for me. I like to think of myself as always being in transition, you know, transforming and becoming something over the years, never one thing.
That was Amy Tan. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I talked with Amy Tan a couple of weeks ago, pre-recorded the interview. We're playing it now because she's coming to this year's Wordslingers Festival, Saturday the 21st at the Veterans Hall in Grass Valley. And as part of KVMR's membership drive, which we've had to extend for a day, we're offering tickets to that event. If you come in at the $89.50 rate, you can get a pair of tickets to the main floor of the Veterans Building. That's a $50 value for $89.50. And if you come in at the $60 rate, we have tickets. We have three sets of tickets for the bleachers. That's normally a $30 value. You can call 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867, which is also 1-800-355-KVMR. This program, when I walk down the streets, I hear a lot of people say they like it, and I know a lot of people are excited to know that Amy Tan is coming to town. This is an opportunity where you can support this program, you can support KVMR, and you can also get yourself some tickets to see Amy Tan this Saturday. So that's 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. We have a number of other premiums, which I mentioned earlier, but we have two more guests I want to get to on the program, so I'm not going to say anything more about them right now. Just encourage you to call 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. The next person I have here on the phone is Jason Roberts, who's a Bay Area writer. He's written for a number of publications, but his first book has just come out to great reviews. It's called A Sense of the World, How a Blind Man Became History's Greatest Traveler. And Jason Roberts will be here at the bookseller this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. Welcome to Booktown, Jason.
Thank you, Eric. Pleasure to be here.
This is a fascinating book, and unfortunately we only have a short time to talk about it, but this man, James Holman, you say covered a quarter of a million miles. This is in the time of sailing ships and early steamships, but hardly any railroads, no other mechanized transportation. He went the distance from the Earth to the Moon, much farther than anybody else had ever done. How did you find out about him? Because I'd never heard of him.
Yeah, it seems to be that he had almost slipped off of our entire cultural consciousness. I just found about him while killing time in a public library. I picked up a reference to him in a book called Eccentric Travelers. It was just a little chapter. Turned out that that was the only thing written about him in the entire 20th century. He had been born in 1786, and died in 1857. And as you point out, Eric, by that time, he was into the Industrial Revolution, the steamship age. But what's really interesting is that his travels were not conducted on railroad trains or anything of that sort. It was almost completely done exactly the same way Marco Polo would have traveled, which was on sailing ships and on horses and carriages, that sort of thing. And he was, in fact, the most prolific traveler of all time up until the invention of the internal combustion engine. And, of course, the most unique thing was that he was completely blind.
Now, Marco Polo, you mentioned, may have traveled about 14,000 miles, and Ibn Battuta, the 12th century Islamic traveler, may have gone 70 or 80,000, but Holman went four times that much.
Yeah, that's pretty much my rough estimate. It's actually hard to nail down because the last 20 years of his life, the records weren't kept that accurately. However, we do have some reports from the Linnaean Society of London that are able to kind of tally up by a rough estimate. I'd say it's at least 250,000 miles. The man spent about 50 years in almost constant motion, and that's what you can do, I think.
And he was not only blind, he became blind when he was about 25. He was nearly penniless, and he was supposed to, as part of his retirement from the Royal Navy, stay in one small chapel near Windsor Castle. Somehow he managed to get away from there and travel around the world blind and with almost no money.
Yeah, he had been a naval lieutenant in the build up to the War of 1812, and about 1808, he was off the coast of the United States, and the exposure to the elements caused him to get severe rheumatism. In his early 20s, he was effectively crippled, and he was coming back from that. He was recuperating from that, and then there seemed to be another syndrome that caused him to go entirely blind almost overnight. And as you point out, Eric, he managed to live in Windsor Castle in company with King George III, and he would have been taken care of for the rest of his life. But he kind of rebelled against that notion because he realized that he needed to go off and, if not see the world, at least experience it as directly as he could. So he kind of bent the rules and got a lot of people angry at him. But yeah, he would simply plunge completely into the unknown, completely unaccompanied, not even knowing a word of the local foreign languages.
And he experienced it just as fully sighted people did, maybe more than many fully sighted people would.
That was one of the revelations that I came across in my research. Is I thought that I knew what it meant to be blind in terms of you close your eyes, you think you know what it's like to be blind. But that's like saying, you know, you jump out of a tree, you know what it's like to fly. I really understood that the non-visual world is actually more complex than the visual world, that we use vision as a means of simplifying, of recognizing things and putting things into groups. Best example would be, say, a brick wall. You and I would look at a brick wall and simply say, that's a wall. But a blind person would experience each one of those bricks with its individuality. So that's why I end up making the claim, which I stand by completely, is that James Holman, in fact, experienced the world more vividly and completely than anybody before us had.
And he wanted to go places other people wouldn't. When he climbed up Vesuvius with some sighted companions, he noticed after they stood on the edge of the volcano that they were at the top of the volcano, but not the top of the mountain, and he wanted to go farther. They refused.
Yes, they had to point out to him that it was, in fact, in the middle of the night, and that if they had proceeded beyond the glow of the lava, they would be completely in the dark, and he had to concede and say, okay, well, that's a problem for you, but not for me, but I'll move right along. Essentially, James Holman, he was very famous in his time. He was almost generically famous as the blind traveler, and actually, Charles Darwin cites him as an authority in The Voyage of the Beagle. Sir Richard Francis Burton also cites him in the translation of the Arabian Nights. I mean, he had actually been quite well known. He was a fellow of the Royal Society. He'd been a best-selling author. And very interesting that I needed, in terms of researching his life, I needed to answer two questions. One is, how did such an amazing thing happen? How did this person get to travel completely alone? And then secondarily, how did he become so forgotten? What was it in our national makeup, our consciousness, that made us forget that this had been such an incredible hero? And I believe that he should be up there with the Helen Kellers of the world as somebody who provides, I don't want to use the term inspiration, but kind of like this golden standard of what you can do in your life.
You mentioned in the introduction to the book that earlier editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica had, I think, six paragraphs about him. The 11th edition in 1910 had one, and after that he dropped away completely. But when I looked him up in Wikipedia, he's there, has a good page, most of which is based on the 11th Encyclopedia Britannica and on your book.
Yes, it's very interesting, the response that I've been getting from people, that he does seem to be getting restored to public consciousness. The feedback that I get, particularly from blind people, has been almost overwhelming, and the book has been selling very well, and it seems to be striking a very responsive chord out there, that the people do have that sense of rediscovery. And that's what I wanted to share with the reader, because I felt like it was a privilege for me to be putting these pieces together in kind of a race against time, because a lot of these records were due to be destroyed, as a matter of fact, and I was able to kind of slowly start putting it together. But I wanted to share that sense of discovery of this person, and then also to have it feel what it was like to go along with him when he would enter a new world and not know anything about what was going on, how you piece that together. It's a very interesting three-dimensional puzzle, and I hope to convey a little bit of that in a sense of the world.
Well, it was very exciting to read, and I know there are historical characters like Alexander the Great or Abraham Lincoln or Winston Churchill that I've read numerous biographies of, and I'm always interested in the slight new interpretation, but in this case, it was a total revelation. And the last time I can remember something like this was when I read the first biography about 30 years ago of James Augustus Murray, the first editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. I'd never even heard of him and found he had a fascinating life, and James Holman had an even more fascinating life, and I'm so happy to have, well, that you have exposed me to him or him to me.
Well, we're very fortunate that we're living in this new age of narrative nonfiction, and actually I have to thank James Augustus Murray, and more particularly Simon Winchester and the later book on him, which was The Professor and the Madman, that the success of that book, or say Dava Sobel's Longitude, has all of a sudden created a market for biographies of people that weren't necessarily famous people. For quite a long time, a biography was needed to be equivalent to the fame of the person that it was about. So now publishers are starting to take chances on books like this. And he was somebody, you know, who was famous in his era, not quite enough, I think, to warrant a book like this, say, 50 or 100 years ago. And now I think we can really understand there's a lot of amazing stories to be rediscovered because we're able to kind of set our sights on that level of semi-obscurity, semi-fame.
So are you setting your sights on some other subjects?
Yes, it's pretty amazing how many wonderful stories there are out there. In the process of researching The Blind Traveler, I came across five or six other stories that are equally compelling in very different ways. I mean, The Blind Traveler was himself just a unique individual. I think there's nobody quite like him before or since, but I am very interested in telling some more complete stories that we haven't quite heard of before.
Okay, well, I'm quite looking forward to seeing them. This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thoman. I've been talking with Jason Roberts, the author of A Sense of the World, How a Blind Man Became History's Greatest Traveler. He'll be appearing at the Bookseller in Grass Valley this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. So thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Eric.
This is a membership drive on KVMR. We had it scheduled originally through Sunday. We've extended it through Monday, which means I don't have quite as much time to talk to some of these authors as I might like to, but it means that we can offer you some things we wouldn't otherwise have been able to. Most important of these is Amy Tan. We played an interview with her earlier in the hour, and she'll be in town this Saturday, the 21st, at the Grass Valley Veterans Building at 7:30 p.m., and we have tickets for that for anyone who'd like to become a member of KVMR. In this case, you're helping KVMR, you're supporting Booktown, which is always makes me feel good, and you're getting something wonderful for yourself. You can call 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867 and get a pair of tickets for Amy Tan. We have four pairs, different seating arrangements dependent on the amount you pledge, but it's a great opportunity. We also have Amy and David Goodman's new book, Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back, and Noam Chomsky's Hegemony or Survival, and Molly Fisk's Essays for Radio, Using Your Turn Signal Promotes World Peace. So give us a call at 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. I also have in the studio with me a local author and performer, Mark Lyon, who has been conducting tours of, what do you call it, Haunted Nevada City?
Haunted Nevada City, yes.
Over the last couple of months. And this Thursday, he will also be appearing in Nevada City at 7 p.m. at the Miner's Foundry with a one-man play called Ghosties and Ghoulies and Long-Legged Beasties and Things That Go Bump in the Night, in which you play 18 people?
18 different parts over the course of the evening. And during the course of the evening, I tell five different classic ghost stories, dramatized in such a way that we get a flavor of all of these different characters.
And the stories take place in very different locales?
Absolutely. In fact, the first story takes place in ancient Rome and is what is thought to be the oldest recorded ghost story. This was recorded by the Roman historian Pliny the Younger, and it was in a letter that he wrote to the emperor. He'd heard this particular story of a haunting that had taken place in Athens and wrote to the emperor and said, "What do you think of this?" In my interpretation, however, there's a little more humor than Pliny had when he wrote the story.
And where do the other stories take place?
There's a story that takes place in what was the old sailor's home in San Francisco, which it was torn down in the 1920s, but until then was on Rincon Hill and was alleged to be haunted with a number of ghosts. There's perhaps the most, what would I say, the most unique ghost story I've ever read in my life, involving a woman who dreamed about a particular house. And what happens when she finds this particular house is the crux of the story. There's a story, and I should say, of the five stories, four of them I think are true, including this next one, which involves an Irish Romeo and Juliet type of story and strange phenomena, which continues to this day in Ireland, and which I actually observed myself on a trip that I made to the little village just to find out whether the story was true. Then there's a fifth story that involves leprechauns and talking corpses, and that may be a little iffy as to how true it is.
And as I said, you play all these characters. Do you have 18 costumes, or how do people know who you are?
No, actually, there is a framing story which I utilize, in which I come out dressed all in black with a red, or I should say burgundy, hooded Irish cape, and in which I establish that I'm in a cemetery reading epitaphs, which bring to mind the different stories to me. And once I get into the different stories, however, I don't change costumes. It becomes theater in which you use your mind to imagine the costuming and the setting.
You've done tours of Haunted Nevada City. Now you're doing these Ghosties and Ghoulies. You have a morbid imagination.
Not at all. Not at all. I have, I think, perhaps an unusual imagination, but I find that through collecting ghost stories, and I've been doing this all of my life, that actually, rather than being macabre or morbid, that it's somewhat uplifting, because it, at least to me, has proven that once our physical body dies, we continue to go on in a different form. And so I find that to be a rather nice concept.
Any idea? Do you want to? But if you were going to come on in a different form, would it be a spooky one?
Oh, no, no. If I were to come back in another form, I think I would want to interact in a way that I'm helpful to people. And there are ghosts that have been known to do that over the years.
Any of your stories about helpful ghosts?
no, these ghosts all seem to have their own agenda. But although we
they have things to finish up that they hadn't completed.
Yes, and although we do have very helpful leprechauns in the last story.
Okay, this is Mark Lyon, who's, as I said, has been leading tours of Haunted Nevada City, and he's going to be doing one-man performance, five ghost stories with 18 characters at the Miner's Foundry this Thursday at 7. It's called Ghosties and Ghoulies and Long-Legged Beasties and Things That Go Bump in the Night, and it's free.
It is absolutely free. It is being put on by the library and the Friends of the Library. And we're looking upon it as a gift from the library and the Friends of the Library, and Beverly Marks, who will be backing me up on the piano and singing a couple songs, and me.
And is this something that it sounds like you've suddenly hit your stride in these topics? That you told me before the program you have something like five different productions you're working on right now.
Right. It is. Really gotten a little bit out of hand in October, because I've got Haunted Nevada City, I've got Haunted Grass Valley, which an actor friend, David Briggs, gives every Saturday night in Grass Valley. Then there's Ghosties and Ghoulies, and there is going to be something called the Haunted Train over at the fairgrounds, where they have a setup of the narrow gauge railroad, and I've written a script for a presentation they're doing there. And then I go off to Winters for a week to perform in a Victorian Halloween show that I wrote, which is performed there every year.
So you've definitely, Halloween is your time of year. What do you do in February?
Well, in February I generally write, because I have other one-man shows. I have two one-man musicals that I've toured with, mostly through Canada, but last fall I was in Ireland performing one of them in a number of castles there. And so I do a lot of writing during the winter, and then the rest of the time I do my performing.
Okay, this is Mark Lyon, who's going to be doing Ghosties and Ghoulies, a full title, Ghosties and Ghoulies and Long-Legged Beasties and Things That Go Bump in the Night, a free performance at the Miner's Foundry this Thursday at 7 p.m. This has been Booktown on KBMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm making way for Jimmy Accardi. And